Good evening. Assalamu alaikum. Lovely to see each one of you, and particularly lovely that we can gather this evening and think about this young man and do so with Dr. Xanakis and Mr. Dennis Edney. I'm David Doa, director of the Chester Rani Center. We've joined with the MICA Center and Amnesty International here at the university for this evening's gathering. It's going to be pretty straightforward. I will have Mr. Edney introduce Dr. Xanakis. He will talk for a period of time. We will have a chance to have conversation with him and explore the various themes and avenues that he has laid out for us. I want to draw your attention to a fresh off-the-print press's copy of Arlette Sink's marvelous essay, Love Knows No Bounds. The Rani Center has just brought this out. It is on subtitled A Christian Response to the Omar Khadr Story. There are copies there that you can help yourself to later in the evening. I don't think much more needs to be said. You all are aware of the fact that Omar Khadr was born in Canada, a Canadian citizen, was moved to Afghanistan when he was 10, at 15, captured in a firefight by the U.S. military, has spent a lot of time at Guantanamo and then in Millhaven, and is now our neighbor. Mr. Edney, would you please introduce our speaker?
Good evening. I'm only up here for 1 or 2 minutes to introduce Dr. Stephen Xanakis. Stephen Xanakis, I think, is better to introduce himself. I met Steve in Guantanamo, so he will give you the background to Guantanamo and share his experiences in Guantanamo. But tonight, for me, the specialness of tonight's evening is that I am hoping and I am positive that Steve will give you the same perception of that young man called Omar Khadr that I have been talking about for years. I've gone everywhere to talk about Omar Khadr, and I sometimes giggle when people ask me why I'm representing him. And I say, as a so-called former tough criminal lawyer, that I've never met anybody who is so special, who is so wonderful, who would be such a contribution to the Canadian, to Canada, and to each one of us, than Omar Khadr. And so, Steve, I'd ask you to come up here. I look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you all very much. It's a great privilege to be here. I am very grateful to be in your company and have already felt great inspiration and love that you bring to what you do. And so I want to start by recognizing you and your colleagues for all the good work and your mission as you carry it through in your daily lives and professions. I want to particularly salute Dennis, which I know is apocryphal almost as an officer. But he is a great champion, and all of us are better for having him on our side, and Omar's particularly blessed to have him as his lawyer. I want to also recognize Arlette Zink, who, as you know, an exceptional woman. I think that says it all. So I am enriched by being in their company and having spent these past 2 days, 3 days, I guess, in Edmonton here, and now being able to engage with you in some conversation, which is really what the purpose is of this evening. Because what we're going to talk about is not easy, and it's not comfortable, and it shouldn't be, because what we're going to talk about is the essence of our humanity. And I heard in the gathering before, one of the guests was talking about her recent visit to the Holocaust Museum and how she had noticed that there was a change in the theme, and I hope I'm quoting it correctly, but the theme there of what you do matters. And that's, in fact, what this individual represents, is our opportunity to consider and wrestle with what we do and understand that it matters and that it's basic to our humanity, and to many of us it's basic to our faith. But it's not easy, and I in part want to start with a little bit of my biography of why it's not easy and why this case and this individual has been so troubling for me. I'm a psychiatrist and have done general medicine and psychiatry now for 40 plus years. Graduated medical school in 1973. I was commissioned in the Army in 1970. My father was a career Air Force officer. I grew up in the military. My family is all from an island of Chios, Greece, which is off the coast of Turkey. My one grandfather was born in Turkey and emigrated there. That family came here in the midst of lots of war and conflict, and that informed their lives and subsequently informed my life. And they came to the United States, as many Americans did, and as many of your ancestors and family came to Canada, because that country represented opportunity and promise and a form of government and fairness that they could not get anywhere else in the world. In the mid-1960s, when I graduated high school, my father was stationed in Japan flying to Vietnam. I had to make a decision, as did many of my classmates, about how we were going to in fact, complete our obligatory military service. It's not that we uniformly supported the Vietnam War, even in the military community that we grew up. I particularly had grave doubts about that war. And the way that we conducted it, and I knew a lot about it because my father was flying to Vietnam and been flying to Laos, and he shared the stories. But also our approach and perspective to these Asians. But I decided that I owed my country back, to pay back my country for what they gave to my family and the opportunities that they gave my grandparents and parents that they would not have otherwise had. And that I was going to serve my country in the best way that I could, and I was going to serve it honorably, and I was going to serve it with commitment. And I did that. I tried to do that. Things turned out that I took a scholarship. I was fortunate to get accepted to Princeton. I went to school. The world in the 60s turned upside down completely. And those of us who were affiliated with the military were a very small minority. But I was not going to bail out of a promise that I had given. And so I completed my scholarship, was commissioned, trained in combat arms. One thing led to another. I decided that I was going to go to med school. I did not end up going to Vietnam in the combat theater. And I didn't read the fine print of my contracts. And what I thought was a 4-year commitment turned out to be 18. Well, that's a long time. So I said, I'm going to make the best of it, and realized that I could do well. I could bring a change. I could help soldiers and their families and this country by being the best soldier possible. And I was fortunate to have a mentor who said, you can be a general. And so that's a big responsibility. But I decided to do that. And had commands and responsibilities that helped fulfill my aspirations, my values, and my sense of commitment to humanity. Roll the clock forward. In 2004, I had already retired and had to reorganize my life. And I was invited to interview for a position of principal deputy, essentially the number two job in the Department of Defense for all healthcare. And the interviews went through, and it was at that time that the story started to come out about Abu Ghraib. And I was, like many of you, just shocked. Just shocked. I certainly understood the fear. I certainly understood the sense of vulnerability that we had in Americans, as Americans, with the attack on the World Trade Towers. But what I saw about Abu Ghraib was not what I thought, and what I signed up for is what American soldiers do. It was wrong. It is wrong. And I disclosed my feelings. I didn't get the job. But that's fine. I mean, you have to make choices. You have to live by your conscience. My wife said, you have an important message, and encouraged me to write an op-ed for the Washington Post. I did. It appeared in the Outlook piece, and I was, turned out, the first retired general who had spoke up against these, what I would call, it's a stretch, but I'd call them atrocities because that's how they felt. From that, I began to get calls to particularly one group that was important, because it was a group of retired generals and admirals convened by Human Rights First who were going to come together and inspect our policies by 2005 of what we were doing in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and particularly what we were doing in Guantanamo, and most importantly, how we opposed torture. This group included General Powell, General Krulak, who had been Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Hoare, who had been a former CENTCOM commander, William Howard Taft IV, the grandson of the president, who had been the Deputy Secretary of Defense and the General Counsel of the Department of State. These were committed, professional Americans who had very responsible jobs, who were coming together and saying, what is happening here is not right. And that group has stayed together and continued to oppose torture and has advocated for the closure of Guantanamo. Shortly after that, I was attending, I was the only physician, to my surprise. I'm just shocked that there were not more retired generals or admirals who came forth to join and speak out. But that may be some commentary on how hard it is to engage and to do the right thing. I was at a conference with some of these men and at George Washington University School of Law, and was approached by then the defense lawyers for Omar Khadr. And I'm a child psychiatrist as well as an adult general psychiatrist. And I was asked, would I, without being told the name, would I agree to go to Guantanamo and evaluate someone who had been apprehended in Afghanistan and was accused of terrorism? I would not be truthful if I did not disclose to you that I had a very uncomfortable feeling and a crisis of conscience. I have that crisis with every case that I'm approached to work on. Because this issue of defending people who are accused of terrorism is a head-on collision of my principle, my training, and my work as an Army officer to defend my country against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to do what needs to be done to get the mission accomplished, and my role as a physician, which is, if someone comes to me, I'm obligated to help them and to do what I can in their interests without judging them. I had no idea who Omar was. I had no idea what the case involved. I had some feelings about, obviously, I opposed torture. I opposed the interrogation techniques that were being used at that time. I had misgivings about the way the war was going. That's not my area. I can't speak about it. But I did not understand the facts of this case. And that's really what I want to be able to share with you. Now, it took the defense team 2 years, from 2006 to 2008, to clear me to get to Guantanamo. That, to me, is shocking. Now, the qualification was that we had a young man who had clearly suffered a concussion in the early moments of the firefight, had been abused that the government denied, had been severely wounded, and was still suffering with the medical consequences. And the defense team says, we need a psychiatrist who understands these kinds of neurological as well as psychiatric and medical conditions. And that was my wheelhouse. That was the area I was working in. It took 2 years. I finally got to Guantanamo in December 2008. I had no idea what to expect. I had no idea what the camp was like. I had not been there before in my travels, although I was in part had been when I'd been the commanding general of my the Southeast for the Army. I'd been had some oversight, but it was just not one of the trips that I was going to make. And I got there, and it's hard to convey how desolate the place feels. How you come in and feel that as you get off the airplane and take the boats over to where the camps are and where you're going to stay, you feel that somehow souls have been hijacked. And then I met Omar. I'm very emotional. I hope you all challenge me on my objectivity. I hope you all challenge me on my professionalism. But the fact is, I cannot at all wrestle with what needs to be done here and talk about this case without being emotional to my core. Now, I went in to my first interview with a psychologist, Kate Porterfield. She's an exceptional woman. She had met Omar before, and she had another case. And she, somewhat, you know, cunningly, decided she was not going to prepare me for Omar. She was not going to tell me who he was and what kind of man this was. And of course, you know, I expected to meet a terrorist. And I walk in, and here is absolutely one of the gentlest, most decent men I have ever met in my life. In this little room where all these interviews occur, Camp Echo, sitting in what had been cells before, where some of these men, when they had brought down, had been imprisoned. Just drab as can be, shackled, so his leg is shackled to an eye bolt on the floor. So plastic table, these plastic chairs, and he's sitting there, stands up and says, "Hello, salam, welcome, thank you for coming." And I'm disarmed by this, completely disarmed. But, you know, of course, maybe I'm being tricked. You know, these guys are cunning. You know, they've got bags of tricks that the rest of us don't have. They've been trained. There's the Manchester Manual, right? You know, they've been trained to, you know, this is asymmetrical warfare. You know, and I've got all these other guards around me. I mean, they're all in army uniforms and you know, I'm feeling the military kind of rhythm going on here, and here I'm a general and all that kind of stuff. Maybe I'm being tricked. And so I said, let's sit down. And we start just having a conversation. And he asks about me and my family and what I'm doing here and what happened. And I ask about his family. And I can't, and that just starts what's been a relationship now for close to 5 years, culminated in the past 2 days. I've spent, 6 hours both days with him. And there hasn't been an instant, not an instant, where I have felt that this man has been other than what he presents himself to be and how he has tried to, in the most humane, honest, thoughtful way, engage me and everybody else who has come into his life. And no matter any time, and it's my professional responsibility to ask myself, am I being fooled? Is there something that I'm missing? I can be fooled any day, any time. There's plenty of, you can ask my family, they'll tell you that that happens more than they like. But I have not had ever the feeling that this man is other than who he presents himself to be. And he does it instinctively. It is in his DNA. So I walked out of that first interview, and Kate says, you want to talk? I said, no. And I start pacing. I'm a pacer, as you can tell. I mean, I'm a walker. And I start pacing around Camp Echo. And I pace, and I pace, and I pace, and I pace. Finally, Kate says, you need to come back. I said, she says, she looks at me, she says, how do you feel, Steve? And I had no words. She says, you've been gooed, you know, out of the Ghostbusters. The goo has hit you. And Guantanamo's finally gotten you, and you're just covered with what is the disconnection, the incongruities, the discrepancies, the disparities, the gaps in what you're seeing and experiencing and feeling and what all the publicity and rhetorics and politics is about. And it's finally hit you. Well, I'm shocked. And I start to try and unpack that a little bit. How did we get there? How did this country, by this time in 2008, start to have a public face about what this war on terrorism was? And then to meet this individual who in no way conforms to that public image? And then my fellow officers in the Human Rights First, by that time in 2008, we had the opportunity that also brought to light some of these political issues, and that we interviewed every presidential candidate in 2008 who was willing to meet with us, a group of about 10 to 15. I mean, we met President Obama, we saw Senator McCain, we saw Hillary Clinton, we saw Joe Biden, we saw them all. And we spent hours in confidential, talking about Guantanamo, torture, Iraq, all these issues. What came out of it, what the combat arms senior general said, at the core of what has happened to our country has been that we have been manipulated by fears. That we were shocked by the World Trade Towers, and then the fear factor was played in that we had to go out and get every Muslim out there. They were all dangerous. Not terribly different than what we saw in the 50s with the Communist Red Scare, for those of you who remember that. We were diving under desks because at any day, maybe I don't know how they were going to help us, but any day that the atom bomb was going to come, we were diving under desks and chairs. Except that, as General Krulak and General Hoar said and published, fear is not a strategy. Fear is not the basis that governments go about and deciding to go to war and effectively prosecute their wars. But that's what had happened. We were backed into the corner of fear, and it was clearly playing out in the 2000 campaign, if you all remember those debates, because 24 was on the air, and it was all about torture, and at any moment, you know, some city's going to get blown up, and if we don't torture this person, we're not going to get the information, and more innocent Americans are going to die. So fear was at the basis of that. The other thing that was at the basis was the stated policy, we were going to take the gloves off. That policy violates everything that if you're a career officer, you've been trained to do. It undermines everything that is strong and capable about a military force. I just in case so I don't mess it, there's a great quote from General George C. Marshall. And he, you know, is a wonderful leader. So let me just kind of tell you how that happens. He said, and he laid it out in 1942. Once an army is involved in war, there's a beast in every fighting man, which begins tugging at its chains. And a good officer must learn early on how to keep that beast under control, both in his men and in himself. 1942, George Marshall. But what we did was we threw all those principles away. We said we were going to take the gloves off, and there were no rules when it came to the intelligence we were going to get and how we were going to treat these people. That is corrosive to a military. It undermines a military's effectiveness. And in my eyes, as a military professional and psychiatrist, it is no surprise that we had the sport killings that were and the convictions in Fort Lewis, that we had Sergeant Bales, that we had the unfortunate incident of Major Hassan, that we've had any number of reports of what have been absolutely heinous acts by Americans in the course of war. Sometimes a country has to go to war. As hard as it is, and you may argue as a theologian about just war, but sometimes countries have to go to war. They do not have to throw away the rule book. And that's what happened here. When you dive into the case of Omar Khadr, that's what you see. You see that people, for some other purpose, imagined objective, military objective that they had, that they threw away the rule book on him. It's to his credit that having been subjected to that, he has not absorbed any of it. It's to his credit that he looks for decency and consideration in every person. Let me tell you about the facts as I see them. And I'm not the lawyer, so I'm not saying this in any way of what should be argued as the defense. But when I got the facts of this case, here's what I heard. First, he was 15 years old, sent by his father to this compound to translate for these men, who very probably very realistically were training local Pashtuns to make IEDs. They were a threat to American security. Omar was set at 15, so he's 15 when this happens. Secondly, the Americans attacked the compound. There were maybe four people at this time in the compound. And we had a company of American special forces and infantry, that is at least 50 to 75 people, with some Afghan nationals that attacked the company, that attacked the compound. It took 4 to 6 hours for finally for them to get control of the objective, military objective. I'm not an infantryman, but that's a botched operation. It shouldn't take 50 trained American military that long to take over a compound with four men, one of whom was a 15-year-old. In the first moments of that attack, after the first rounds were fired, Omar was placed in the middle of a courtyard by the men there, almost like a decoy, to be shot at. It's my interpretation. Americans attack with Apaches and A-10s. They're low-level Air Force fighters. Omar is wounded, has a wound through his leg, has shrapnel, and is knocked out and is bleeding severely. He has no memory from that point on until the time he's on a litter and being taken by the American military in a helicopter, probably until he wakes up in the military hospital. My call was he suffered a concussion, clearly, with that first firefight, and obviously was bleeding out severely from the wound to the leg. What I could construct was that one of the men pulled him into an alcove and protected him while the rest of the firefight occurred. Towards the end of the firefight, someone threw a grenade. There's nothing in the record anywhere where we knew who threw that grenade. And the grenade was thrown about 30 feet. How many of you have thrown grenades? Right. How many of you have thrown grenades from your knees after you've had, you know, a wound and shrapnel in your thigh and probably blinded in your eye? I've never done that. It's pretty tough to throw, and to throw a grenade 30 feet. But not even asking the question, if I attacked your house, or I had 50 people attack your house, can you defend yourself? You know, in Florida, they call it stand your ground. I don't know how it is in Edmonton, but you could have a whole artillery down there, you know, and fight it out. So he's attacked, right? Someone throws a grenade. Unfortunately, Sergeant Spear, who's an infantryman and a medic, not wearing his headgear, his helmet, suffers the, you know, gets shrapnel from the grenade. He dies 10 days later. Omar's the only survivor. And from that firefight is what ensues in the court and the accusations that Omar has committed murder. That's the murder charge. And if I'm wrong, Dennis, you can correct me on the facts later. But that's the murder charge. At the end of the firefight, after supposedly the grenade was thrown, he shot through the upper left part of his back. He has two M16 wounds. To this day, he has medical problems with that as a chronic infection. Not getting medical treatment for it, actually. So from there, he stays in Bagram. He's treated at the hospital. He's interrogated in the hospital. Improper as a medical commander, it is not appropriate to allow interrogators to come in under those circumstances. I thought that was a violation of the regulations. He's manipulated with medication being given, not being given. There are all sorts of harsh conditions in Bagram. From Bagram, he is sent to Guantanamo after his 16th birthday. I think it was probably very clearly a clear purpose and to make sure he'd aged out at 16. And then all the things start happening at Guantanamo that you read about in the news. And all the evidence is he was subjected to sleep deprivation, to walling, and to human mobs, to abuse, and he's 16 years old. And he's thrown in this environment. So by 2010, when the time first comes for us to start to decide how he's going to get out, the plea unfolds. And the plea gives him 8 years. He was facing 40 because of a set of charges that now have been challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court of material support. And this is the set of cases that are going back to the U.S. Supreme Court. Those charges were based on a set of videotapes that have been taken of him interpreting and as the Libyans having the compound were training locals to make IEDs and then in order to put them in. That's the young man who now sits in this prison in Edmonton. Now, he's been labeled dangerous, a radical jihadist, a rock star, unrepentant, lacks remorse, killer. How does that happen? How does it happen that Dr. Porterfield and I, and I think even some of the psychologists, now they're part of the Canadian defense, the prisons, have that kind of opinion, and the prosecution expert, Dr. Wellner, has another completely different, because that's what you see in the news. What you see in the news, what has been picked out of Dr. Wellner's report, is being used to depict this man as the face of terrorism. That he becomes the symbol for what's supposed to frighten you and me of enemy who may in fact commit, who may harm us and our homes. How does Omar Khadr end up being the foil for that? So I'm going to let you make your choice. I feel somewhat awkward about this because I am clearly in disagreement with Dr. Wellner. But I'll tell you my side of the story. And it starts with the fact that what Dr. Wellner testified, he said that as a forensic psychiatrist, he is specifically trained to look at cases objectively. And those of us who are not forensic psychiatrists, who have that, and I've not been trained, lack objectivity because, of course, we want to help people. I guess that's wrong. I mean, and we are easily duped. And hijacked by sentiment. But then you dive into the interview, which I guess is still classified, and about 16 hours. And you see that Omar Khadr, I find that the most flawed and unprofessional interview I have seen probably in my career. Have done that's that importance. Unfortunately, the defense lawyers pulled in another psychiatrist named Mark Sageman to also review that and render opinion, and Mark's opinion is public. The interesting thing about Mark is before he went to med school and got his PhD and then trained in psychiatry and in forensics, he was the CIA station chief in Afghanistan. And Mark is very involved now with training Department of State and CIA people. He knows danger. He knows who's a threat. He knows what comes out of the hills there. And Mark said, this judgment by the prosecution expert is flawed. It's flawed because it didn't even conform to our usual standards of practice. This, you know, the usual ways, patient comes in, you get a history, You engage them, you go through, you do it, you do a, your own assessment, you do a mental state, you do other, I mean, there's just a pattern that is ingrained in us as clinicians. And that did not happen here. Who introduced the term radical jihadist? Not Omar. Dr. Wellner introduced it. And then when Omar did not confirm it, Wellner accused him of being evasive. And in fact, trying to manipulate him by not at all, you know, signing up for this attribution. Who introduced the idea that he was a rock star and was going to, well, it's Dr. Wellner. When you talk to the guards, if you talk to any of the guards, any of the people around them, you know, they found him a very decent person, thoughtful, good to work with, not a problem, never had a problem, just like the rest of us. Wellner, and I did write another op-ed that appeared in the Washington Post, Wellner took radical jihadism, a political idea, and made it a psychiatric diagnosis. And that's that is a professional error. That's what the Soviet psychiatrist did. That's what other psychiatrists in totalitarian regimes do. If you don't agree with the ideology, they label you as crazy and warehouse you in some facility. And that's what happened here. So when you look at the facts, when you unpack the case, when you meet the person, when you let him reach out to you and you reach out to him, which comes naturally, the facts do not in any way support a characterization of him as dangerous, as a political agent, as a leader, as a someone who's a threat. He has absolutely no interest in politics. I mean, he does not want to talk about politics at all. He wants to go into healthcare, frankly. You know? If he could be a doctor, he'd be, but he's so far behind, I think, in education that that's not going to happen. But he wants to go into healthcare. He's interested in art and music. Politics, I've got no interest for him. So I hope what I've been able to do is inspire you and motivate you to look past all those labels and slogans and get down to the facts. Now, this is not easy work, and there are definitely times, as I have been met again with Omar and then find myself asked to meet with other accused terrorists, that I will have a recurrent crisis of conscience. Is what I'm doing really making America, the free world, these democracies safe? And there's definitely a moment that I feel like saying, you know, this is too hard, I can't do this. And then my wife reminds me of the axiom from Sir Edmund Burke, and her parents were survivors of Nazi Germany and of Austria, actually in Hungary. She says, all is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. I don't know what if I'm a good man, but I certainly feel like it's not, I couldn't live with myself to do nothing. And I think that it's important for all of us, for our democracies, to go out and act on our conscience and to affirm our convictions, and for those of us who feel to live our faith. And well, thank you so much.
Dennis, would you join us? So are there some avenues here you'd like to explore? Who would like to begin, please?
Okay, so
just one moment.
Okay, so I think one of the interesting things you brought up was the whole idea that psychologists in your field are just too motivated by sentiment. So, but then, see, obviously, when you say about Whitmer, he was obviously motivated by his prejudice and racism and even fear. So isn't that a sentiment? And I have a second question, too. So also tying into the whole racism idea, what would he say about Henry Kissinger?
So let me just look, the struggle in medicine, I think the struggle in any profession, is that there's always an art and a science to it. And I think that we cannot at all try and presume that either one is really what prevails and does what we do. I do feel, in terms of recognizing the sentiment that we have, that this is the old Greek saying of gnosi aston, you have to know ourselves. I think all I can do, and I would ask all my colleagues to do, is to be honest about who they are, to be clear about what their prejudices are and biases are about what they're doing, and to understand how they're influencing the respective judgments that they're making. I mean, it's what makes us, I think all of us tries, it inspires us to be good doctors.
Thank you.
Okay, so my question is this. If I understand you correctly, it appears that the other psychiatrist, Dr. Wellness, or whatever his name is, he seemed to use political or ideological terms as medical or diagnostic designations. If that's the case, then has there been any effort to have the American Psychiatry Association, if there is one, or perhaps psychology or medical association, analyze his use of the terms, political terms, as medical designations, and then come against them and say that these are not medical designations, so either do a new study, or at least throw up the old study. So has there been any effort in that regard?
There's been a lot of active debate about it, and I think that there is a consideration. In fact, I'm leaving here to go to a meeting in the American Academy of Psychiatry and Law. I was invited there last year as their keynote speaker to talk exactly about that, and that we needed, as a profession, to be very, conscientious about how we go about and do what we did. So I think there's some backlash.
Please.
Just to add, actually, it's a comment about the diagnosis. I mean, this is not new. I mean, we've seen it here. I can talk about Canadian, like the DSM, how homosexuality was diagnosed as a disease. And I can't remember what... which area in North America, like during the feminist era, how psychiatrists labeled some of the women. So this is not new.
Right.
Thank you.
Can I just ask a question? So you describe Omar as a decent, sincere person, and from what we know that he's been through, as a mother, I can't help but thinking how he turned out that way. So
we'll give you the Nobel Prize if you can figure out. I think we all ask ourselves. I mean, it's the old nature-nurture question. You know, what was it, what is it that he has? That, and why is it that some people do survive absolutely horrible situations and are just beautiful, gifted individuals? And or was there experiences that he had that we just don't know about?
Just a moment. Would you, just one moment? Would you, when you, if you don't mind, when you go and ask somebody, just stay with them, okay? So that, just in case they have some further thing to say.
How does he feel about his parents?
Is he bitter towards his parents? Yes, he does. He has contact with them, you know, the prison system.
But he's not bitter
towards his parents. No, he's not bitter.
I'd like to hear Mr. Edney speak to that as well.
I've had the privilege of mixing with meeting people who have been tortured. And contrary to the word tortured, and contrary to people with expectations, rather than being angry and wanting to commit violence to perpetrate repercussions to come back to get revenge, what I've seen is people such as Omar, people such as former British detainees who were in Guantanamo and returned to London. And there are even people here I know, at least one person here who suffered torture in Chile. And they, I don't know the answer, but they become far more human. And their desire is to make the world a better place, but more than that, their strong desire is to ensure that what happened to them would never happen to you. And I see that through Omar. Omar, for years, talked about being a doctor. Why did he want to be a doctor? He wanted to help people. He wanted people to be helped and never to suffer like he suffered. So it's not an unusual phenomenon.
Thank you.
You mentioned that you interviewed Barack Obama and other major U.S. politicians. In 2008, Obama was he was a huge advocate for shutting down Guantanamo Bay, and now it seems like he doesn't really care about it, care about closing it. What do you think changed between Senator Obama and President Obama now to make that, huge jump in his morals, I guess?
I probably shouldn't talk about areas I'm not an expert in terms of political commentary, but I think that as we've watched this as a group of generals, we've seen a couple things. One, it turned out to be harder to do than he thought it was going to be. Secondly,
just politically,
politically harder.
Getting it through.
And then to move the detainees requires there's a specific funding authorized by the Congress. And then once the House turned Republican in 2010, then that really blocked many of his efforts to move those detainees. Because he has executive authority, but it can much backfire in many ways on him. The Abdul-Mutallab underwear bomber incident in Detroit in 2009 also caused some backtracking, if you remember that event, because he was trained supposedly by Alapi in Yemen. And about, we have 86, there are 164 detainees now in Guantanamo. 86 are cleared, have been reviewed for transfer. Of those 86, about 48 are Yemeni. And so it's much of the movement of the closure has been to move them to Yemen. But once Yemen Obama did say that it was no longer considered a safe reception area for them, he stopped the movement. He is regenerating that effort now. And in fact, a very close colleague of his, Senator Durbin, who is the second, the deputy majority leader in the Senate, had several of us testify to the Senate Judiciary Committee. I testified on July 24th, and you're seeing some momentum growing to move these people. Now, is it going to be easy? No. We've just been through a shutdown. It was an absolutely absurd circus. We have a problem with increasing the debt limit. In order to get the funding, it requires what's called the National Defense Authorization Act. All that funding comes through that. That's going to have to get passed. So the president, irrespective of what might be his good intent, it just can't wave a wand and make it happen.
He's not a dictator. Alas.
I had that same concern, that same question years ago. I was in Guantanamo when Obama talked about closing the place. And I remember a psychiatrist. I thought it was Steve. It may have been a psychiatrist in California, but I attribute this to Steve, saying to me, you know, if we open the cell doors of these detainees and we let them out into the sunshine to meet the cameras of the media, you wouldn't see the Taliban warriors who have been working out in the gym, which captures the imagination of the American public. You would see the broken, the destroyed, the tortured, all of them who have suffered. And I give you that example because Obama had no idea of what, and I still think the same, had no idea then, and perhaps has no idea now, of really what Guantanamo was all about. I don't forgive him for not closing, but it gives you a sense, for me it's a sense of this guy doesn't really know what he's got here. How do you close him?
Well, I mean, that is a problem, and I'll take the quote. And thank you. Yeah, don't worry. But the other, so just as a civics lesson, and as a former Army officer, there's a skill set of working around your bureaucracy. And I know that when the senators and the congressmen and the senior DOD people go to Guantanamo, they don't see what Dennis and I have seen. They don't see the faces of the people and hear the stories and are able to feel what their state of, you know, what their lives are like. They get a completely different story. And the change in organization is a whole other art form of coming in and around and figuring out who's going to tell you partial truths and all that. So there's a lot of that that's been happening here, and I'm hoping that, you know, now that the years have passed, people have gotten a lot wiser about it, and that they're going to do what is absolutely. I mean, the movement to close this place is strong.
Is that aggressive? Thank you. Just a moment.
Thank you very much. I'm really so grateful for your talk tonight. And when I heard Ezra Levant talking about Michael Wellner on and on and on when Omar was being transferred back to Canada, I looked in the Journal of American Psychiatry and found an essay called "The Recurrence of an Illusion" that talks about Michael Wellner and the limits of his forensic psychiatry, and says that he uses moral and theological terms where they should be scientific terms. But I think one of the problems is we live in a country at this point where our government doesn't believe in science. In fact, we've been internationally condemned around the world for muzzling scientists. And there is a problem with telling the truth about Omar and having it resonate in the public sphere. So I'm so glad you're here to tell your story, and I appreciated reading your op-ed earlier. I just have a question. During the military commission, I think you were at one point going to speak at the military commission, and then you didn't. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that. I actually think if you'd spoken, maybe it would have been easier for there to be more opposition. That's not to condemn you for not speaking in any way, but just the fact that at the military commission there was only one psychiatrist meant that there was a tremendous effort to just foreground his words. And they could say, well, he was the person speaking there, and there was no defense psychiatrist. So I know it's a very strange and arcane process, these military commissions, but I just was wondering if you would speak to that.
I have to defer, and I did at the time, to the judgment of the lawyers. They I have a son who's a lawyer, and I've been advised and consulted and trained a lot by him. And so I defer in that way to my great professional colleagues. It's their decision. I'm the expert. I come in with what I think is, you know, the resources that I can give to them. And I really respect how they decide that they can use them or not use them. And it's really out of my wheelhouse. I really can't give you much more than that. Sorry.
This confession, quote unquote, what does it have validity, or was he coerced? And was he advised by some American lawyer to confess for some strategic reasons?
I think Mr. Eddy should probably take this question.
Well, we'll talk more about that when Sam Morrison comes in November, and he and I will talk about the challenge that we're going to meet, both in the federal court and in the U.S. Supreme Court, to overturn Omar Karif's convictions. The reality is that I persuaded Omar Karif to plead guilty. And Omar Karif did not want to do that. And one of the reasons he didn't want to do that was because Canadians would think that he was a terrorist. And what you have to understand at the time was, notwithstanding, had Omar Karif had gone through the whole trial process and be found innocent, the military commission stated that it still would have the option to keep him forever. So even if he was successful in trial, the possibility, the strong possibility, that he would remain in Guantanamo, one. Two was, when I looked at the composition of the so-called trial process, it would take too long to get into because I want to really focus on Dr. Zanakis' comments. But he was facing a military jury, handpicked, a military judge, handpicked, military prosecution, military defense counsel, eviscerated of defenses, eviscerated of witnesses, they have a chance in hell. And that was borne out by the 40-year sentence he was given. So yes, Omar Karif did not want to plead guilty. He was persuaded to do so. And he's here today. Along with plead guilty, what I was not aware of was he had to agree to a variety of facts. And those facts were so ridiculous, I wouldn't waste your time talking about it tonight. But what I would point out to you is that everything I've just told you about his plea bargain, the Canadian government at all times had a Department of Foreign Affairs official coming to Guantanamo. I would speak with him or her, present at the trial. And your government knows very well, Mr. Harper knows very well, that Omar Karif's trial was a farce. He knows very well everything that I've just said to you. And the language that the public continue to hear is that he pled guilty in what we understand to be a properly constituted court. It wasn't. That the public is made to think that he was afforded due process. He wasn't. In fact, one of the some of the evidence used against Omar Khadr at the trial was derived by American intelligence officers and Canadian intelligence officers when Omar was 60 years of age. And their conduct had been ruled upon by the Supreme Court of Canada, which said that the United States had violated the Geneva Conventions and the International Convention on Torture with regards to Omar Khadr, and that Canada had been complicit in that misconduct. And the prints of that misconduct was used in that court against Omar Khadr. He didn't have a chance.
But there'll be opportunities to explore this dimension of it.
Yes.
When your colleague comes in about 3 weeks or so.
I'm going to ask a simple question, and I know it's a very complex one. And I'd like you to talk a little bit more about, I think, the real underlying dynamic, and that's the fear factor that's so much part of what I see as the American DNA, and it's been around for a long time. And I guess the question I have, I'd like to hear you talk about it. Where is that really coming from? And secondly, who within the machinery of the U.S. government or military has the interest in perpetuating that fear? Because that's what seems to me is what's really going on here. There's a group, a very small but powerful group, that has the ability to perpetuate the fear, and they do it extremely well.
Well, that's a great question. Maybe we'll get you to write the great essay. because it is fundamental to what's going on here, and it plays out not just in this arena in terms of defense. It plays out in another arena that I'm very involved in, which is dangerousness and gun violence, because I'm advising some senior government officials on what I think are more effective policies when it comes to restricting the guns. So not being political and how the various elections occur and Congress gets elected and what it is for their districts, I think I'd have to put that aside. But I think you can see it in the campaigning and what in some ways plays out with the Tea Party going on. From the military, as a senior officer, I think there are two issues that almost make the fear factor a default. What I have not seen in the past 20 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall is I've not seen good doctrine come out of our senior military leadership and our political leadership. And by doctrine, I mean is sort of that body of work that similar to what came out after World War II with George Kennan and the X Factor and what guided us during that period of time. And for better or worse, I mean, it may have been derailed when we went into Vietnam. It certainly did shape what our defense policy and our international strategy was going to be. But we don't have doctrine now. I cannot point to something that's come out of the past administrations. And that's personally what I'm looking for in the next president. I was hoping that we would have gotten it now. Secondly, I think the factor is that the machine works. I mean, there is a military, industrial, consulting. There's a business here. And there's a lot of money in the defense industry. And they've been clearly invested in certain technologies and other military support apparatus. And if we're going to have a change in doctrine or we're going to reduce our force, it's really going to affect that industry. And they're a very, very powerful lobby. So I see those two factors. And then I think there's a host of others that come into the sociology and mentality of the American public.
Did you want to probe that a little further?
Well, that's where I assumed you would go, because not only a student, but an actual participant, although indirectly, the Vietnam War, the exact same dynamic was going on. But as Canadians, we're really puzzled by this fear factor, and we're puzzled by your love of guns, but it goes right back to your War of Independence. And then I read a book, I can't remember the title of it, but it was The Fear of the French Attacking the United States in the 1780s, and it was the first time I really understood the fear factor that became embedded in the U.S. Population, and that fear factor has been there ever since, and you've always had a real clear enemy, but that it's not so clear anymore, and that's been a real attempt, and I see that as really problematic. And it really debilitates what America is able to do in the world because of this, what we would see as this irrational fear. Because America is arguably the unbelievable phenomenon in the scope of world history, but this fear is really what's holding you back from being that light, which I think America has been.
I take your point about fear, but it's not just directed at the United States. The fear factor is alive and well here in Canada. I've spent 10 years going back and forth from one end of this country to the other. I've spoken to numerous audiences for years, ad nauseam. And you use the word terrorism as the doctor talked about. People don't want to come here. Fear is alive and well here.
Well, and I just want to add one thing that I wanted to add specifically about Omar. I mean, in terms of, and I have no place to comment on your society or your politics, but if he's labeled as dangerous because it's a fear factor, then that is absolutely an inappropriate and irrational situation, because he's not dangerous in any way. And I frankly cannot believe that he's being kept in a prison setting. I mean, you all know what prisons are like. And the people in Guantanamo are not of a prisoner mentality. And that's the culture of those detainees, who they were. Many of whom were just pulled out of the hills and the mountains, you know, the villages, and sold for bounty. I mean, there were 850 people. Many of them got there because of it. So they're not... They don't have a prison mentality, no matter what the American government continues to say. And the American government will propagate that, and it did recently. There was an article in the Washington Post about that Al-Qaeda is still influencing the population at Guantanamo. It's probably the most absurd proposition I have heard in a long time, and somebody in the government needs to be medicated. And if Omar's dangerous and you're putting him in a prison population, particularly a max, you know, and knowing what he's exposed to, that's just wrong.
Talking about max, so Dr. Zanakis talked about Guantanamo, but this is Guantanamo not. In Guantanamo, you're not allowed to see or speak to any of those detainees. It's left up to your imagination who's there, and the fear factor that you talked about. No different than today. Omar Khayyam, the Undersecretary of State, in transferring Omar to Canada, provided a document designating him as a minimum security prisoner. Someone they had no problems with in Guantanamo, someone, as the doctor talked about, was well thought of, even by the toughest and the most meanest of guards. He gets to Canada. We, without paying any attention to all the reports, this doctor's reports and many others, and other recommendations, designate him as a maximum security threat to Canada, a maximum security threat to the institution. Put him in Millhaven, where Bernardo is. Locked him away for the first 7 months in isolation. Let him out, and then put him on a food chain in the kitchen. And he's told the rules are you can only get one piece of butter. And he follows the rules, and because he followed the rules and refused to hand over any more butter than was properly allotted, the prisoner tried to stab him, and then put a cop on him. And Omar goes back into solitary confinement. He arrives here in Alberta, and we really welcomed him. Because we put him on a white supremacist unit. And in the first 15, 20 minutes of arriving there, he gets beaten up. And he's not allowed to speak to you. He's not allowed to be interviewed. You don't get to hear the voice of Omar Khadr. You only get the voice of Omar Khadr through people like ourselves. Because the Prime Minister's office refuses that. And it's not me who says that. The warden of Millhaven approved a media interview of Omar Khadr on two separate occasions. And the Prime Minister's office nixed it. I would dearly love the public to see this man. So, what is the difference between his treatment here and the treatment in Guantanamo? In some ways, it's worse. Because he's mixing with an element that he wasn't mixing with in Guantanamo.
Was there somebody up there? Thank you.
My question here, maybe Dr. Steve and Dennis can respond to it, but also Arlette, if you see that she is present. The image of Omar Khadr, like, for God's sake, he's just a kid. Why that case? What I see really as selective compassion. Why wouldn't he be treated as a soldier kid? Why would that never happen or put into perspective? Or was he also a victim of a vilification process in terms of having a kid capable of doing atrocities? Is that the image that the media tried to convey about him?
Well, let me try and answer that. That's a great question. I appreciate that. But I think the question is, how has Omar become an object of vilification? How is it, that he has not been regarded as for his status as a 15-year-old and therefore as a child soldier, which in that case Wellner specifically did comment on. So my window of understanding about that, and he's also asked Arlette to speak. My window of understanding comes from many conversations I had during when the plea was being discussed, and particularly with the prosecution. And my perception of the senior leadership of the government, the Department of Defense, because at that same time we were meeting with the presidential candidates. One is this element of American law that 15-year-olds in many states, and I think not being a lawyer, and I think in the federal court system, can be prosecuted as adults. And they are prosecuted as adults. And so it's not, and Dennis, you may know the American law better than I do, but it was, as the lawyers, I argued that he should, you know, I'm a child psychiatrist, so I'm going to come to this conversation from an understanding of development and what I think is expectable behaviors at certain ages and stages of a person's life. And what I saw in this 15-year-old was absolutely normal behavior. It was not illegal. It was not criminal. It was not intentionally in any way dangerous or harmful. I saw normal behavior. And if you were considered, in my view, appropriately as a 15-year-old, then he would not have been prosecuted. So my argument was dismissed by the lawyers because of aspects of American law that I don't understand, that we often prosecute 15-year-olds as adults, and particularly when it's a capital offense. So So I thought that was one issue that played here. I absolutely disagree with it. Second issue that played is we had a murder, quote unquote. And here's the first detainee who's identified as a murderer and for a death of an American soldier. And that had all sorts of play in the media and across the political debate, particularly in 2008. Remember? You know, here we are, we're ending, you've got this intense, election about who's going to succeed. Are the Republicans continue to succeed? They were the people that baptized this war and set it up. Was it justified? Was what they did make sense? And were we going to continue to, were the policies going to continue? And so here you have a person who is going to be condemned for murdering an American soldier. And I didn't see, they were not going to, from what my experience was, they were going to not back off from that. And I thought as it played out, those were the two big issues here.
That's satisfactory. There's a gentleman over here.
Beyond the case of Omar Khadr, I'm continuing with the angle of child soldier. I'm wondering what there is in Canadian policy or law, what is Canada's position for defending or protecting child soldiers?
Well, Canada protects child soldiers. Just doesn't protect Omar Khadr. Canada spends millions of dollars along with the United States in dealing with child soldiers in Sierra Leone. In fact, the special prosecutor for the Sierra Leone trials in America was prepared to come to Guantanamo and testify on behalf of Omar Khadr. He wasn't permitted. And so, yes, Canada, under the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Child Soldier Convention, there's so many international treatments and conventions and treaties that Omar Khadr is entitled to protection under the Convention on the Rights of the Child and so on. Our country subscribes to them, but doesn't follow them. When you subscribe to an international covenant, and one of your members, and one of your citizens, is harmed under that covenant, you are required to advocate on his behalf. We're the only Western country that didn't criticize Guantanamo, and we did nothing to assist Omar Khadr. But coming back to your question on child soldier, our government, for some strange reason, and I've never been provided with a legal opinion from the government, their position is he's not a child soldier. And because they say it isn't, then I guess it is. Thank you.
We'll have one more back there before we bring things to a conclusion. Please, thanks.
I was just wondering, how is it even possible that he was charged with these crimes when there's no concrete evidence of him actually throwing the grenade?
Because America is a great power. Because people like us have never challenged it. We keep going to war and we keep expanding the rules of the battlefield, say through drones, for example, without going to court first and getting authority to legitimize what we do. I was in the Supreme Court of Canada, in the United States in 2002, where we were fighting for the habeas rights for Guantanamo detainees. Because the government said, or Bush said, that are entitled to any protection. Many, many rules have been made up along the way. The fact that Omar was called a non-combatant at the time, a designation that had now changed, a non-combatant could have been just as good as a marshal. Because what it meant is you get no protection whatsoever. and nobody stood up.
Oh my God.
Now you are public, now the government, he has been left in this vast wasteland. And so what I always say is, none of us could ever think of ourselves as a civil society when we allow a place like Guantanamo to exist. We used to criticize the American, the Russian gulags. We've got one. We've got one on the southern tip of Cuba. We've had hundreds and hundreds of Muslims locked away there for years without any trials. We've been abused and tortured. We know that. We watched them, these figures being taken across the ocean and locked into cages wearing these red outfits, chained and shackled. No different than the slaves of yesteryears or yestercenturies. Because we don't challenge and we don't ask questions. And the question is the one you ask, it's a proper one. How could we have allowed this to happen? It's because the government sees it is.
No, I mean, I don't particularly, I just want to thank everyone. And it's a great privilege to be here. And it's very inspiring to have time with you, to know that, you know, I guess amongst us that we as good people can disagree, but we do it in a way that is meant for the betterment of all of us. Our democracy is, and this is a lesson I've had with this case particularly and others, are really anchored in the rule of law, not in fighting wars or killing enemies. And we're here to do that, and we're here to, again, affirm that we believe in that, and that we're proud that our governments can, in fact, enforce the rule of law, and that good things will come out of it. I really thank you very much for the evening.
Will you join me?
Thank you. Thank you.